Good morning, Mateusz.
Good morning, Vern.
I saw some sort of headline about your array of violin concertos that you have done. Do you have a box score? Do you have a list on the practice room wall or something?
Well, no, I don't have a list on the practice room wall, but in my head there's a bucket list of pieces that I would love to play with the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And one of the really, really big ones was last year when I did the Brahms. Mm-hmm. And this year it's another big, big, big one, which is the Dvořák Violin Concerto, which happens also to be very closely related to the Brahms, mm-hmm. because it was composed only a year after Brahms's concerto. So in a way that there's a time connection as well as people's connection.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because the name that gets thrown about was this character, Joseph Joachim, who I guess was a pretty good fiddle player. What's the story about him and what kind of person was he?
So, essentially, in a nutshell, you have this virtuoso violinist that is performing the new works of art that are kind of the hottest item on the market. Mm-hmm. He happens to be the friend of Brahms. And Brahms, who is pianist himself, you know, when he's trying to write a violin concerto, where is he going to get an advice on how to make the things sound really, really good? So he says, hey, man, can you help me out with this? And then, of course, Joachim says, no, this is unplayable. We got to change a few things, which, thank goodness, Brahms actually agrees. So makes it playable. Still hard, but makes it playable. So what happens is that Dvořák, who happens to enter a competition for composers, Brahms is a judge on that competition. He finally finds Dvořák, finds his music very inspired, and he finds him gifted, and he introduces Joachim to Dvořák. So Dvořák, having that opportunity of interaction with a great fiddle player, thinks, maybe I'm going to write my violin concerto, and I'm also going to get some cliff notes of how to do it well, which Joachim does. He almost overdoes it, because apparently he's hard on Dvořák, to the point that Dvořák only wrote one violin concerto. Mm-hmm. I think Joachim probably comes in from a perspective of I'm the famous one. Mm-hmm. You're the young composer, and I'm going to tell you how to do things. And probably that didn't really sit great with Dvořák. Maybe, I think, discouraged him from writing more violin concertos in the future. I mean, which is sad, because this one is a masterpiece. But it's fascinating to me that as you play and you research those things, you come across just a human story. You know, one big composer, one upcoming composer, one virtuoso, and it all somehow comes together and creates this absolutely marvelous music.
And for a minute, about how using somebody like Joachim, where it helps, where maybe it doesn't help. Like, for instance, if something was playable but really hard, is Joachim going to completely squelch a good idea, or is he going to have a little latitude and say, well, maybe I'll practice a little harder and it can be done? Where's that tension?
Well, you know, I mean, that is absolutely fascinating, because as a student in the school, I had a situation where some young composer would come up and say, like, hey, can you play my piece? And, you know, and I'm reading through this and I'm like, oh, man, you know, if we just change this one note, this passage that you want to be played really, really fast, it actually can sound much, much cleaner. So that's like a small thing. So, you know, let's take one note or add one note, because sometimes composers don't think about it. A lot of composers are pianists, and, you know, that's the bane of our existence, that pianists use five fingers. They can play five consecutive notes really, really easy. On the violin, we actually use four fingers. So for us to play four consecutive notes is easy. Five, all of a sudden, creates all sorts of headaches. And you manage that, but it's definitely not easy.
And so, when Dvořák and Joachim got together, what was the result? Did it work? Was it fireworks? How much did Dvořák agree or not?
You know, it's very interesting, because from what I've been reading, the Joachim had more problem with the form of the piece, you know, rather than the actual playing bits. Mm. And I can completely, well, in some ways I do agree. What makes this particular piece very, very challenging, and I remember when I was trying to play auditions for the orchestras, and, you know, what are the big violin concertos that you want to show off? You know, you have a Beethoven, you have Brahms, you have Sibelius, you have Tchaikovsky, and Dvořák. And every teacher that I ever encounter says, oh, no, you don't do Dvořák for auditions. One of the reasons is that the way he writes the beginning of the piece, he gives you those two incredibly difficult and virtuosic cadenzas, and like, he throws you in at the beginning of the piece, right into the deep water, and as soon as you get to play for like literally 20 seconds, he brings the orchestra. So you just started warming up, he stops it. So then he gives you an even harder one, 20 seconds later, and again, you play for 20 seconds, and he stops you. And then there's the orchestra. And then finally you get to get rolling, which makes it really quite challenging, because it almost feels like a two false starts before the music actually just gets going. And it's definitely not comfortable because of that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, because wouldn't you prefer to just go play a pretty tune for a while?
No, it's like, Brahms' violin concerto.
Yeah.
In a post, he makes a big introduction of the orchestra, and then he lets you open big, and then you're just rolling. And whether you're stressed out or not, you have time to start to feel it. You're going to kind of find your groove. With the Dvořák, you have to virtually in your hand find the groove and really become part of the orchestra, even though you're not playing. But the only way, I think, to find a continuity in that opening is to just kind of live it and enjoy the orchestra playing the parts that you're not playing.
And speaking of enjoying the orchestra, when you go out there and there's a long, long orchestral introduction, is that good or bad for your attitude? You're saying, come on now, I need to get going playing, or does it kind of get you in the mood?
That's a great question. I think it depends when. There is actually few places where, in this particular piece, Dvořák works you to death. I mean, your fingers are, they are spent. So at that moment, when there is an orchestral interruption, you're almost out of breath and you're like, thank God, I have like, 30 seconds to collect myself, because this was a really hard workout. You know, it's like, it's like when you're doing sets in the gym and you want to have that 30 second break or a minute before the sets. It's the same thing. That is great. But sometimes it's like, right when you're like, if you're using the gym analogy, you have your New Year's resolution, I'm going to the gym, you packed your bag, and then all of a sudden some very interesting show on the radio comes on. And you find a really good excuse not to get out of the door, listen to the show or something. So that's essentially, so then the introduction might be bad.
Very good. Great analogy. Mateusz Wolski, who's going to be playing the Dvořák Violin Concerto. Now your job for the last few months has been to learn the notes, to memorize the piece, to do all that, but it's also been to really get close to the piece and, I presume, make it your piece, make your own decisions. Even though I do know about you that you are willing to listen to great violinists of the past and think of the legacy. Talk kind of about your internal learning process versus the external.
So how, for me, how the process works. On one hand, you're trying to be very religious when you are learning a piece and trying to see, okay, did the people before me that performed it, did they start to modify? Did they become the Joachim? And did they start to modify the text to make it groove better for them? And therefore disregard some certain markings that Dvořák would put. Was there an editor somewhere along the way that thought, yeah, that sounds pretty good, but let's correct Dvořák? So on one hand, as an artist, you're trying to go back to what the source material was in its original form. On the other hand, yes, there has been a wonderful group of musicians that on certain occasions, they might have actually found a better solution how to let's put it this way, adjust certain markings in the piece to make it flow a little better, to make it more exciting. Mm-hmm. So you have this kind of, straddling of the line of where do I go? Then you have this whole aspect of there are certain tried and true fingerings or bowings for the piece that have been refined over the course of performance. Now, when you are a student, what typically happens, that's why you want to study with the great people, is that they have kind of the little tricks and deep knowledge of, yes, you can do it this way, but, you know, there's this one fingering here and there's this one bowing here that makes it just so much cleaner. And that used to be in the past, before the YouTube, that used to be the thing that you really wanted to pay your money for. You went to somebody that was unbelievably great at playing it, and they could give you those secrets. Today you actually can look at the great artists, and thank goodness with playing the violin, you can actually, if the camera is in the right place, see the finger, see the bow, and therefore you can try it and test the things that people done before you and see if they feel comfortable to you. Because the big part of playing something as virtuosic as the Dvořák violin concerto is you need to feel comfortable in order to be able to get through it, you know, flawlessly. So definitely, I love to study the people that did things before me, and also, to be quite honest, this is for me a wonderful treat, but it's also a stretch because I'm a concertmaster, 90% of the year. On our 10 classics, for 9 of them, I'm sitting as a concertmaster, and for 1 classics, I get to be the soloist. And yet, my ambitions are to sound as good as the guys who, 10 times of 10 classics, they come only as a soloist. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely a change of gears in my head to accomplish that. But I love it. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful challenge, and I always find that I've learned so much about the instrument, about being a musician, and also makes me much better when I'm sitting as a concertmaster trying to support a soloist when they come in and play with the orchestra.
Sure. Dej Volsky playing the Dvořák. And you were saying that you brought your violin and that you, and if you wanted to kind of talk a little bit about some of the deep, subtle decisions that you make in learning this
piece.
Yes.
So, one of the things and one of the reasons why I love the repertoire like Dvořák, the romantic mm-hmm. music, it's like, well, as growing up violinists, we all kind of were waiting till we are ready to play this big romantic work. Now, why is that? So I have a little, if you don't mind, I'm going to nerd out just for a moment.
Let's just
show you something. So, for example, Dvořák is using a tune that could sound almost like a folk melody for the theme. So this is kind of what it would sound like if I would play the folk version of it. It's just a nice mm-hmm. little tune. Mm-hmm. So how do you make it sound romantic? Well, you start adding layers. So one of the layers that you would add would be you start to change the tone by playing on strings that make the thing sound a little darker, a little warmer. So see, that sounded a little different. Still yeah. sounds kind of plain, but sounds a little different. Then you start to add vibrato to make things just a little bit more warm than that. See, so that sounds a little different. But then, the one thing that we are actually allowed to do in the romantic music is to use slides. And this is what it sounds like if you add vibrato and the slides to that simple melody.
Yeah, that was a remarkable difference right there. All of a sudden, it just.
Yeah, and you know, and that's one of those things that as you grow as a musician and you develop your chops, you know, and where do I put that slide to make you feel something? Because at the end of the day, you know, I play this kind of music because I want the audience to feel something. I want to grab them by the heart and make them take them out of the reality and take them on a journey. And even though that story here was written a long time ago, I think it's still incredibly relevant today. We all want to fall in love and then live happy ever after and don't worry about government shutdowns and where the next paycheck is coming from. And you know, and that's the power of music, that for that brief moment when we're all together sitting in a concert hall, we just get to experience the beauty of human creativity, beauty of human emotions that are just pure and honest. And I think, you know, things that make us fall in love with each other. And you know, it's just as simple as that for me.
Yeah, well, and very clear and very obvious from what you did about that. So many things about this concerto, because it's not one of the top five most famous concertos. It's, you know,
and then I think that's wrong. It should be.
Well, it should. Well, okay, and that's exactly what I'd like you to defend and say. But just statistically, it's not. It's not the one that violinists go out on the road and tour with.
See,
so much.
I think part of the challenges is just because that dang opening is so hard. Mm. It's, you know, I mean, when you're a big time established star, there's plenty of things to choose from. Of like the kind of the workhorses that are very comfortable, you know, you kind of like get into a zone. It's, I mean, actually in studying of that piece and you know, it's, I can find flawless performances of Brahms or Sibelius violin concerto. Finding a flawless performance, and I don't care who you name, there is the best violinist in the world playing it. Everybody, you know, to an expert ear, struggles just a little bit here and there, and I don't know. Is it because how he wrote it? It's because maybe Joachim should have spent more time nurturing him or something, you know. So, but yet, you know. So on one hand, that's a huge challenge because, you know, it's like, man, how am I going to outdo somebody? If even the best in the business have a little bit of issues with this, but the music is so beautiful that, you know, whether I hit 100% of the notes or not, I think that that's not really the point. That's not what Dvořák was after. I'm still hoping to hit 100% of the notes. But, you know, I really honestly think that let me tell you one story. Actually, speaking of touring, when I was playing with the New York Philharmonic right after school, I went on the tour. And on that tour, Kurt Mazur was the conductor and young Sarah Chang was the featured soloist, and she was playing the Dvořák violin concerto. And there's this one part in the last movement that Dvořák changes the gears and brings this even more folky melody. And then he reworks it with this gigantic kind of slap on double stops. And I remember every single time when she would get to that part, and, you know, she's one of those players that just plays the crap out of it. I mean, even though she was playing on a Del Jesu, I mean, that instrument barely could, you know, hold all the power that she was throwing at it. But, I remember every single time we came to that part, and the goosebumps, I mean, all the hair on my body were just standing up. And I remember, it's like, wow, man, one day I would love to play that because this is just so cool. So this weekend, it's going to happen, and I'm super excited.
So we'll watch for that place in the last movement, and then think of you, the race car driver, and see if you're about to go off the corner.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's always the you know, that's always a possibility. But you know, you want to drive this piece. You want to drive it on the edge as often as possible, because if you don't, then why do it?
Yeah, and there. The other another thing about this piece, and since it's not quite so familiar, is are they melodies that one clearly knows and recognizes and the famous go home singing to? And certainly the last movement is that quality.
Oh, no, absolutely. If we're talking about it. You see, I find that there is a, the theme of the last movement. It's very similar in nature to this piece. They're exactly the same tempo.
The Beethoven.
That's the third movement of Beethoven Violin Concerto. And and Dvořák was not living in a vacuum. I'm sure he heard the Beethoven Violin Concerto. Mm. And however, if you listen to it, in the last movement, the beat is in three, but the way he writes it, he already is doing hymiola, which means that even though the feel of the piece is 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, he starts to switch the notes after two beats. So, he could do that,
mm-hmm.
but he goes 1-2-3. But that is the Dvořák, I think, really drawing on the kind of Slavic heritage, the Eastern tradition of having the funky rhythms thrown into the music. That's what the gypsies would do all the time. That's what Brahms actually, when he does the Hungarian dances, uses all the time, and it's very exciting. And he carries it through the whole piece. And there's a couple of like really really interesting things that when you look at the score, the way it looks, it doesn't sound at all what it's written on the page. It makes it very challenging to put together between the orchestra and soloist. It's absolutely mind-boggling when you actually start to analyze it. But we'll worry about that at the rehearsal, and hopefully we come together on the other side of it. But it's absolutely fascinating. And but I think that tune is definitely a singable one.
Is that the last? Is that the last piece before intermission?
I believe so.
Okay, so we'll stand outside the door and make everybody sing it.
We're going to quiz the audience. After. Do you remember? Okay, is there any tune that you remember? Honestly, if you think about Dvořák, the going on to creating the New World Symphony, mm-hmm. I mean that's the Dvořák that I think it's very much in this piece. And again, I don't feel like I have to defend it. Mm-hmm. Because the piece defends itself, and I'm surprised that it actually is not being performed as often as it should. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's a hard sell for the audience. I think it's a hard sell for the soloist.
Okay, well, then that's good. You took it on. You wanted to do it. So we'll be the lucky recipients of that. So this is the Dvořák Violin Concerto, which is Saturday night on the concert Saturday night at 8 o'clock Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock for the Spokane Symphony. Also Rachmaninoff and also a composer Del Aguila, who we'll have in tomorrow to tell about his music. So sounds like you're having a wonderful time with this piece.
Oh, absolutely! Can't wait.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking us way down inside it. That's a lot of fun.
You're welcome.
We're going to enjoy that. Mateusz Wolski, who's playing the Dvořák Concerto, conveniently enough, from some years ago with the Spokane String Quartet, they did that string quartet that has a great violin solo in it, a great tune that also was in another form, the Romance for Violin and Orchestra. Here is Mateusz Wolski playing that Romance tune by Dvořák.
Thank you.
Spokane String Quartet with Mateusz Wolski playing the melodic part there of that tune. The Dvorak romance is how it's usually characterized. In this case, it's a movement of one of his string quartets. Mateusz Wolski playing that. So that's how he plays Dvorak. You'll get another chance to hear him play Dvorak Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at the Fox.